Next matter on calendar is number 57579. Amy, is it Bielsfink? Let's go state in the matter. If counsel for our appellant is ready to proceed, please do so, and if you wish to reserve any time, let us know how much.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Schrager, before you proceed, one issue I'd like maybe both counsel could address. It is subsequent time the briefing was completed in this case, we had a U.S. Supreme Court decision on Nevada Commission on Ethics versus Kerrigan, and I believe the Supreme Court reversed the Nevada Supreme Court and held that that the issue of people voting in a city council meetings was not political speech, was not protected by the First Amendment. Therefore, how the analysis was done on the ethics laws should have been done not under a political speech issue like in Citizens United and all. Since either side's had a chance to really address that, you know, if either side has any thoughts on that, if that case may be applicable in any way, I would appreciate it if you would address it.
I will do my best to address that as I proceed. Your Honor, Bradley Schrager for the appellant, Amy Bielsfink. Your Honor, may it please the court, and good morning. Your Honor, my client was charged with 13 felonies for $65 in productivity payments to voter registration employees during the 2008 general election cycle. She didn't make the payments. She didn't come up with the idea for the payments. But the state charged her with 13 felonies under NRS 293-805-1A, which makes it unlawful to provide compensation for registering voters that is based upon the total number of voters a person registers. And if I may, I actually would like to reserve 3 minutes at the end, if that's possible. I beg your pardon. Now, at no time during this process, and this was quickly pointed out by election officials at the state and county level, at no time was the integrity of any election damaged or threatened as a result. At no time was any vote improperly cast in any election as a result. And no person ineligible to register to vote in Nevada was allowed to register. So despite continuing attempts to characterize it as such, this is not a vote fraud case. It's not a voter fraud case. I understand why it's been continually characterized as such and why it's unfortunately returned to in the state's answering brief. Very frankly, it's good press. No politician and no law enforcement officer in the last 5 years in this country has lost a single political point by raising the specter of voting fraud, whether it exists or not. It certainly doesn't exist in this case. This case is about a statute, 293-805-1A, that burdens core political speech unnecessarily, without justification, and is impermissibly vague under due process.
Counsel, what's the core political speech that's being impacted, and how so?
Your Honor, the activity of entering into the act of persuading non-registered voters to register, to participate in the political process, is absolutely and has been found by court after court to be core political speech, and was found by the district court as well, finally, after long arguments. That is, in fact, the core political speech, the interaction to bring people into the political process who are not. That is conduct and speech advocating political change. It is not partisan political change. It is absolutely.
And that seems to be where the difference is in the various jurisdictions, because in reviewing this, I've seen a number of things who don't quite see it the way you're giving it to us in terms of it being this activity, at least the way it's being done, core political speech.
Okay. Well, certainly in the Chandler case, which you cited, and in the Cobb case, which was quite recent, third-party voter registration drives or petition circulation has been core political speech because it involves interactive communication concerning political change. And thus, First Amendment protection for such activity is at its absolute zenith. And because the collection of voter registration drives is intertwined both with speech and association, the question is not whether the defendant, my client's conduct, comes within the reach of the protections of the First Amendment. The question is whether the state regulates it permissibly when it enacted 293-805-1A. Now, this is a very important appeal, but the questions that will determine the outcome of this appeal are, in fact, pretty straightforward. And they come on two levels, First Amendment and due process. And unfortunately, the district court either failed or refused to enter into the proper analysis on either of those questions.
Mm-hmm.
So it's fallen to this court, unfortunately, to make that proper analysis and answer the appropriate questions. Now, the United States Supreme Court, back in the early 80s, realizing the difficulty and importance of election law questions, established what was known as the Anderson test under Anderson v. Celebrezze. And in this, the state and I agree. This is the appropriate test for determining the validity of the statute in question here. The aspects of the test are, a court shall assess the character and magnitude of the asserted injury or burden to First Amendment rights. Thereafter, the court shall identify and evaluate the interests asserted by the state to justify the burden being imposed. That has two parts. The court must look into the legitimacy and the strength of the interests that are put forward by the state, and then most importantly, must determine the extent to which the law being enacted is necessary to achieve those interests. As the court recognized, this is not a very simple test. It in fact involves hard judgments. And though we've argued about scrutiny in the briefs, the Anderson test really involves a sliding scale. Perhaps if a regulation or statute is the establishment of voting precincts or requirements for residency prior to registering or to voting, that would be subject one end of the scale, reasonableness, rationality. On the other end of the scale, when First Amendment activity is involved, and this is First Amendment activity, as I say, First Amendment core political speech protections are at their absolute zenith.
Counsel, how do we look at this in light of the U.S. Supreme Court's holding in Holder versus Humanitarian Law Project?
Perhaps we could discuss that further.
It's a 2010 case, and it seems to be one of the litmus cases these days that we have to look at. So I would expect some comment about that.
Well, I apologize, Your Honor. I'm not in a position to apply the holding in that case here. I don't know of any case, including that case, that would remove the conduct involved here from the protections of the First Amendment and therefore take it out of the Anderson test.
Do you have any comment? Reference the Pennsylvania case of Kelly, Project versus Kelly, which is a similar statute to what we have.
Yes, Your Honor. In that case, and there have been a number of such cases over the last few years. There was a Florida case late last year, Cobb. There was a case 2 weeks ago in Florida, Legal Women Voters, as well as the Pennsylvania case, in which the statute was not exactly of this nature. And in fact, all of these cases, Legal Women Voters, Cobb, Keller, the ongoing case in Texas at the moment, have to be set within the web of existing statutes in the particular state. For example, an Ohio case, much like this one, found that because there were already statutes criminalizing aspects of the voter registration process or the petition circulation process, it was unnecessary to go beyond that, to criminalize conduct, to put extra icing on a cake that was already frosted. This is the danger we have in a case like this. And clearly there are hard judgments to be made here, and the Pennsylvania court made its particular judgment, and the Florida court made its particular judgment on questions much like that. However, set within the web of Nevada law, under a First Amendment analysis, this statute cannot be justified as necessary to achieve any interest, much less a compelling state interest, put forth either by the state or at the time by the Nevada legislature in the early 90s when this law was passed.
Isn't the state argument it's the interest is preventing voter fraud and getting incentivizing people to go out and get turned in more voter registrations and paying them extra money, and that's a legitimate state interest in prohibiting that?
There were actually three successive interests put forward by the state at the trial level and in briefing. Number one was to protect Nevada elections in general. That's not good enough. When you're going to burden First Amendment conduct, you can't simply say we are protecting Nevada elections. Right? That would, in fact, serve to justify the entirety of Title 24.
Counsel, again, we come back to this issue, and you keep repeating it, and I understand that's part of your argument. But we're not talking about something that burdens an individual's speech. We're talking about payment based on results if you hit this quota. And it's not aimed at D's or R's or Tea Party or any particular group, just anyone who solicits if you get paid by the head after whatever. So I'm still looking for this nexus that you're attempting to give us in terms of getting in the top rung of protected speech, opposed to coming down to something less. In all fairness, trying to understand that if we're going to see your position.
Certainly. I mean, I will simply reiterate and attempt to elucidate that the conduct of trying to bring people into the political process through voter registration is, in fact, really a much greater protection than initiative circulation, which has been considered to be First Amendment speech over and over again by just about every court that's looked at it. Voter registration is, in fact, pre-fundamental. It is the core of the core. It is the prerequisite for exercising the basic fundamental right of voting. When groups like Project Vote go into politically underserved areas, politically ignored areas, where voter registration rates are incredibly low, courts again and again have found that the act of interacting with them for political change, not necessarily partisan political change, but change in the level of participation, that is and must be considered First Amendment speech. Whether it's called core political speech or not, it is First Amendment conduct.
How does this regulation affect the organization's ability to register voters? It's not like you're precluding the organization from paying the canvassers.
Excellent question. And I can speak to, what you're really speaking to is, what is the burden here? Talk to me about the burden. Well, the burden exists on three levels. Number one, this is a criminal statute regulating First Amendment conduct. So the burden is on some level inherent. Secondly, as the amicus briefing showed, and as the experience of other states have shown, voter registration groups will lessen their activities for fear of falling afoul of these types of laws. It was true in Texas, it was true in Florida, it was true in Pennsylvania. Let's think about the job itself. Hiring people to carry out this work, it's seasonal work, it's summer in Las Vegas, it's not a career, you're not generating cash flow, you're not making a profit, these are all nonprofits that are doing this. This is not an easy gig to get people to do, I'll be very frank, and if I may finish at least that part of my answer.
Yes.
As the United States Supreme Court said in McIntyre, it is beyond question easier to get people to work for pay under these kinds of circumstances.
But they're still getting paid. I'm trying to figure out the distinction between this situation and Brett versus Bradbury. It's a Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals case. It was fairly recent.
That is true. But in Bradbury, I believe the court read the statute to allow bonus payments, productivity payments. And while there was a sort of range of options for associations like that was applying employing my clients, certainly in the initiative petition context, which is where most of the cases that talk about this particular issue come from, it has been recognized again and again that when you limit the manner in which you may employ people, how you may pay them, you are necessarily going to limit the number of voices and participants that will exist, and you have then necessarily limited the the First Amendment conduct itself. So it's that chain through the First Amendment lens. And frankly, you know, the basic question is, if you're going to limit speech in this way, if you're going to do this, you better have a pretty good reason, and it better be necessary. And that's the bottom line in this instance. Regardless of what the particular answer you find to your question regarding what's the actual burden, the state still has to justify this as being necessary, and they can't do it because of the criminalization of other aspects. It is against the law, a felony in this state, to falsify voter registration forms. It is a felony in this state to sign a declaration under penalty of perjury, which all voter registration forms are, if it's false. It is against the law to cause someone to be registered who is ineligible to be registered. There is no argument and no analysis that I can come up with that renders this particular statute necessary to carry out any of the purposes.
Is the state prohibited from having multiple penalties out there?
No, certainly not. Certainly not. But in creating the web of statutes, including the one that my client was charged and eventually convicted under, as I said, it has to be necessary. So I would argue that it is not prohibited from having multiple penalties. It is certainly prohibited from adding penalties that are unnecessary to achieve their particular interests and managing someone's incentives. Right? There is no nexus shown and has been shown that any of the 13 bonuses paid caused anyone to be registered falsely.
Mr. Schrader, I know we asked you a lot of questions, so perhaps Justice Ogle might consider giving you some more time, but could I ask about vagueness? Yeah. You also raised the issue of vagueness and due process, and the words registration, registered, registrars, the term based upon, also the intent issue as well. Could you briefly comment on
sure.
that?
Sure. Mm-hmm. You know, as to the individual terms, we'll certainly rest on the briefs as we put them forward. The based upon idea seems to be the most vague because this, while I read the statute to be much like the statutes that don't allow or ban you from paying per signature for circulation for initiative, that's not what happened here. This is banning a $5 bonus for exceeding productivity. In a manner of rewarding productive employees. Mm-hmm. The intent element, I'll speak to briefly. The district court ruled that you don't really need an intent element because it's built into every statute. There's a default general intent. I don't know that that's true. I haven't found that that's true. And certainly had the state had to prove that my client had the intent to violate the statute, they couldn't have done it. Lastly, about vagueness. The state says, on page 4 of its answering brief, that nothing in the text of this statute would prevent organizers from holding hourly employees to production-based expectations or terminating employees for failing to meet those expectations. That was quite a surprise to me, because as they were trying to support the notion that there's really not much of a burden here because there's just these other ways of paying people. You can certainly terminate people if they don't live up to expectations. This is exactly what my client's co-defendant, Acorn, was charged with. That was in 13 counts that my client was swept up into, exposed to spillover prejudice with a reviled organization in the courtroom with her that she wasn't even employed by. And then in the answering brief we're told, that's not really against the law at all, after Acorn had already pled guilty and the state had done with them. Part of the vagueness analysis is, are there proper enforcement guidelines? Not just can people understand what they're supposed to do and not do, are there proper enforcement guidelines? And we see from this, not only are we differing from case to case in the application of this, we're differing within the same case. And if that's not a basic hallmark of impermissible vagueness, I have trouble coming up with what may be.
Counsel, you used up your time, but we're going to give you 3 minutes for rebuttal. And in doing that, we're going to tack on 3 minutes to counsel's presentation, if he needs it.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court and counsel, my name is Robert Whelan. I'm a senior deputy attorney general employed by the Office of the Attorney General, and I have the privilege and honor of representing the state of Nevada in this case. One of the most pernicious threats to the viability, credibility of a democratic republic is voter fraud, voter registration fraud. Each instance of such fraud saps the public's confidence in the results of the elections. The state has a recognized and compelling interest in preserving the integrity of the election process in voting and in voter registration.
Mr. Whelan, just get out of the box. Why shouldn't we, as counselors advocating, find this as core political speech and have strict scrutiny in terms of the application?
Core political speech has been identified in the cases presented to this court as being petition circulation, ballot initiative circumstances. This court in the Heller versus Givnetta break recognized that that was core political speech and that at that level the First Amendment protection was at its zenith. This is at a level below that. And contrary to counsel's representations, the cases that he cites with respect to voter registration as being quote-unquote core political speech, when examined, do not stand for that proposition. That is not to say that there is not a First Amendment involvement in that. However, the problem that counsel has with his arguments is that he has not established, nor does the record below establish, any nexus with core political speech, even if this court were to determine that registration of voters is core political speech. As I said, in response to evidence demonstrating that the process can be corrupted in precisely the fashion the statute addresses, the Nevada legislature enacted 293.805. And contrary to counsel's representation, there was evidence of fraud. That's how this voter registration fraud, that's how the investigation in this particular matter began. The Clark County Registrar of Voters informed persons that the Acorn people had presented false registrations, and so the investigation was commenced. Before I go further, though, counsel broached the amicus brief in this particular case, and counsel's reply brief makes reference to exhibits that were attached to the amicus brief in this matter. It is the state's position that those exhibits cannot be considered in any fashion in this particular case. First of all, they aren't part of the record on appeal in this case. The amicus is not a party, therefore whatever affidavits were presented to it cannot be considered. The affidavits presented by amicus are not part of the record and cannot be considered. The record on appeal pursuant to Nevada Rule of Appellate Procedure 10 consists of that which was presented to the State District Court. The state has not had the opportunity to challenge the factual assertions contained in either exhibit. The defendant in this case, the appellant herein, had the opportunity when she made the motion before the district court and at the hearing before the district court on this matter present evidence. She didn't. The only thing that she presented was, as an exhibit attached to her motion, was a failed proposed amendment to a statute. It's our position that that is totally irrelevant because what we are examining is this statute, not some proposed amendment. Therefore, it is the state's position that Ms. Boosfink's arguments and references to that are entirely inappropriate and they should be disregarded. As I said, was alluding to, counsel said there was no integrity threatened in this particular case. However, I believe that statement is entirely incorrect. This also dovetails into counsel's argument about existing statutes. An analogy would be, everybody knows that if an airplane were to crash there is likely to be substantial loss of human life. Indeed, and in fact, it is rare that anybody survives an airplane crash. You don't have to know, or, I mean, it is a matter of common sense that if somebody were to bring a bomb on board an airplane or to try to bomb the airplane, that it is most certainly permissible to make that unlawful. And you don't have to wait for somebody to detonate a bomb, bring a bomb on an airplane, and bring the airplane down in order to make that activity unlawful. And as I said in my initial remarks, in response to evidence presented to the Nevada legislature of exactly that kind of conduct, the legislature enacted 293-805. One of the problems, as counsel has stated, the Anderson-Salvezzi case, however, in examining the burden in this case, and counsel identified the burden, the core political speech, or what he was most concerned about in this case, is persuading a person to register. Yet it is entirely unexplained by the record in this case how there is any burden placed upon that activity at all by this statute. Counsel presented no evidence showing that there was any such burden. The statute does not completely prohibit payment of canvassers. There is no showing that there is any burden on the interaction between the canvassers and the registrants. There isn't anything that keeps any of the canvassers from saying, well, you know, you ought to vote, you ought to register to vote for whatever reason the canvasser seeks to present. There is no showing on record in this case that there was any burden on the ability to collect signatures. There is no showing that the statute limited the available pool of people willing to become canvassers. There is no showing that the statute would increase the cost in obtaining voter registration in Nevada. There is no showing that the statute in any way impeded any conversation between the canvasser and the person sought to be registered. The statute does not prevent payment of bonuses entirely. Now, counsel has cited and taken out of context a statement that is in our answering brief. It is very clear that in the context of the brief that we are talking about paying bonuses. Bonuses are permissible, however, they may not be based on the total number of persons registered or the total number of persons registered in a particular political party. They could pay a bonus on, well, you covered 3-4 city blocks on your shift. You canvassed and spoke to X number of people on your shift.
What's the policy concern then, specifically, if you have bonus based upon the number of blocks covered or any other measure as opposed to how many people you're signing up? Your policy issue is concerns fraud.
Well, we're good.
Incentive to falsify the number of people you actually sign up.
That was exactly the basis on which the statute was enacted. That testimony was before the legislature. And indeed, it was what is of concern. If you say, as in this case, Project 21 Blackjack, if you get 21 or more people to actually register, within your shift, we're going to pay you an additional amount of money. Now, council tries to make light of the fact that it's $65, but it doesn't make any difference what it is, because what we are concerned with is the incentive to create false registrations.
So let me ask you this, by the same token, you don't dispute the fact that you can set productivity levels. And
you can set productivity levels, Your Honor, on any basis other than the total number of voters a person registers or a total number of voters a person registers in a particular political party.
Right. Right, but you could set productivity bonus or productivity levels, and that can be a basis for terminating the canvasser if they don't meet their productivity levels, right?
You could say, we expect you to contact 100 persons during your shift.
Was there any evidence in this case, Mr. Ruin, that the Acorn people are just trying to register Democrats versus Republicans, or was it just you never even got that far with it?
Your Honor, I don't know that it was an effort to Republicans, Democrats, Tea Party people, whomever. The investigation was commenced because the authorities were notified that there were false registrations coming from Acorn. Like, I do not recall.
So the party affiliation part of that statute never came into play as far as...
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor.
Would you comment? Go ahead.
I'm just trying to get back to the question that I had asked earlier. I'm just trying to work through this. The productivity bonus for productivity levels are okay. And you say you can set a productivity measure of visiting 100 households. Could it be a productivity measure of signing up 100 registrants?
Well, if you say 100 registrants, now you're in the statute's total number of persons registered. Indeed, when we look at
you're not paying them on a per head basis. You're setting a productivity measure, saying you need to register 100 people. Is that okay?
Well, over what period of time are you talking about? They're all managing
a difference. We're getting to the policy issue. I guess my point is, why wouldn't that be as much of an inducement, and why wouldn't that concern you equally as much in the sense of going up and the fraud aspect? If you don't meet your productivity level, you're going to be terminated. Why wouldn't that give the same incentive as here's a bonus if you sign up 21 people?
Well, first of all, it's based on the fallacy that productivity is necessarily measured by the number of people registered. There are other ways to gauge productivity. I just selected, contact a number of people per shift, visit a number of households, cover a particular geographic area, something along those lines. The problem, policy concern, is when you start making remuneration contingent on the number of registrations that somebody has, the moment that becomes the test. Somebody's saying, gee, I'm at 90, I only need 10 more to get paid, or to get my bonus, or to get whatever, and he sits there and Mickey Mouse, Donald Duck, Popeye, Superman, whomever. That's the problem. And that's what is prohibited by the statute.
Mr. Ruin, also, if you could address, maybe in the remaining time, two issues raised by Mr. Schrager, the vagueness issue on the term based upon that he argued, and also the issue of the general intent crime versus specific intent crime. And all.
Okay. With respect to the based upon, I think that's just plain ordinary English language. That issue has been addressed in our brief. With respect to the issue, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
The general intent versus specific intent.
The general intent aspect. The general intent statute is in NRS 193.190, and it says, in every crime or public offense, there must exist a union or joint operation of intention or criminal negligence. That's part of the statute, and it seems to me that Ms. Boosfink's complaint, at least as it seems in her brief and from what I understand, is not so much that the statute's vague, it's that she's in fact been alleged to have been a principal in this case by virtue of aiding and abetting. And in that particular regard, the evidence in this particular case that was adduced at the preliminary hearing shows, and this is why she's covered by this. Mr. Edwards stated that Ms. Brewsting, he had told Ms. Brewsting during a telephone conversation about offering the blackjack bonus and what the bonus was. During the conversation, Brewsting told Edwards that she thought the bonus was a good idea. Mr. Edwards stated that in August 2008, Ms. Brewsting visited the Las Vegas office here, and at that time the blackjack bonus was in place, and there was a whiteboard there in the office that Mr. Edwards testified that Ms. Brewsting saw that the bonus was being advertised to canvassers. She didn't comment about it. There was also testimony at the preliminary hearing that Ms. Brewsting had access to the payroll system, and there were payroll issues that Ms. Brewsting and another person emailed him many times about one problem or another, and could not have done this without looking at the payroll system and seeing that the bonuses were being paid. And Mr. Estrada said that the blackjack bonus was offered and was documented on the whiteboard when Ms. Brewsting was there. It was never canceled. Now, if you take a look at Ms. Brewsting's furthermore, the people that were doing the registration, if you look at the preliminary hearing transcript, I forget exactly what page it is, they were talking about that's what they were doing. They were registering. They were registering voters. And that's further supported by the statute. I direct the court's attention to NRS 293.505 sub 13. A person providing a form for the application to register to vote to an elector for the purpose of registering to vote. And it's a general intent statute, and in that sort of a circumstance, and I direct the court's attention to Baldwin versus State at 121 Nevada 908, 124 Pacific 3rd 191, 2005 case, general intent is the intent to do what the law prohibits. General intent does not require the prosecution to prove that the defendant intended the precise harm or result that eventuated. And it seems that Ms. Wilsfink saying, well, I didn't mean any harm by it. And she suggests that, you know, I was acting in good faith and that kind of stuff. But by the same token, Ms. Wilsfink, by her own words of sentencing, recognized the problem and the stain that this, her activity, put on the electoral process and the problem it caused. Now, go ahead. Going back to the airline analogy that I made earlier, you don't have to wait for somebody to bomb a plane to make it unlawful to bomb a plane, because you know there's going to be harm. In this particular case, the legislature set up very plainly, very concisely, a statute that says this is what you can't do. And that was based on the evidence that was before the legislature about what had happened and what has in fact happened in this case, what initiated the investigation in this case.
I guess one of the concerns we do have is that as you're talking about bombing a plane, which is a act that is harmful, if the intent is purely to register voters and there's no evil intent, as you said, to register Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck, it's purely to register voters, what in fact is the harm?
The harm is the incentive which is recognized, and carrying a bomb on a plane, not just
because if you attempt to register voters improperly, you are in fact subject to other criminal penalties.
That's right.
So you're doing an act, unlike the bomb, that is a legal act at the outset.
Yes.
So just merely doing this and being incentivized to do it to the fullest extent, How is that harmful? How is that, in other words, a bomb?
As was presented during the testimony at the preliminary hearing, they had tried to identify the canvassers, and they were unable to identify the specific canvassers. And because that's a problem, that also provides a basis for the justification of the statute. You go after the person that aids and abets, puts it in place, is part and parcel with putting the system in place. A rough analogy might be precursors to drugs.
We have a final winding up.
Based on the record that was before the State District Court in this particular case, this court should affirm the District Court's conclusion because there is no severe burden placed on the First Amendment rights based on the record. A relaxed burden is proper in this particular case. Nevada statute is reasonable and non-discriminatory. It is not vague. Thank you.
Anything additional? Thank you.
Your Honor, thank you very briefly. The state averts now that its statement in its answering brief going to the vagueness issue, actually the basic issues in the case, that there's nothing to prevent organizers, like my client, from holding hourly employees to production-based expectations. However, we're told that there must be some other way to measure production. It's supposed to be followed around and counted all the houses they go to, all the people they talk to. My client is in the voter registration business. The way you measure that is by registering voters. It brings me to the question of, why are we regulating this at all? That's the basic question under the Anderson test. Why are we doing this?
Well, and counsel indicated, what can you do? If you can't put performance measures in place based on the number of voters that registered, what can you do?
Apparently, you're left with some version of what counsel suggested, which I would clearly argue unnecessarily circumscribes the activities to which my client and her organization should be entitled to conduct, especially without the intent to do anything evil or harmful or unlawful. And there was certainly no evidence, also speaks of the original uncovering of improper registrations. Fine. There was never any nexus discovered, argued, or shown between $5 bonuses paid to anyone to do that thing. There's no connection. Let me say one more thing about managing incentives and also statutes going beyond what they need to do to affect their interest in the First Amendment sphere. In Project Vote Blackwell, which is quoted in our brief at length, the statute required that only the person who actually helps the person register, my client's employees, only that person could then take that form and go to the registration official and hand it in. You couldn't go to a festival at a park, have six people getting registrations, have them all come back in one place, take that pile, take it in. You couldn't go back to a central location to your organization, bring them back, say, here's my 30 for the day, take those in. It had to be you. Well, the Ohio court said, number one, we don't agree with whatever reasons you're coming up with for doing that. Okay, that's burdensome, and there's no purpose for that. We want to open up the ability for people to register to vote. But secondly, look what you're doing when you do this. Perhaps the unintended consequence. Project Vote, or organizations like them, oftentimes have quality control mechanisms over the papers that are handed to them for handing them to the registration office. You've wiped that out. You've actually lessened some of the protections that are supposed to be afforded under the process prior to the statute. May I finish?
Yes.
The same is virtually true here. Why are we regulating production standards unnecessarily when, okay, are there incentives of all times in our society to do things that are untoward to get extra money? Certainly, we don't recommend all of them. We certainly don't do so in the First Amendment context. But we must also recognize that given the facts and the work of the job that these registration people do, the ability to offer production payments is in fact an incentive to stay and do good, effective work in a realm which we should be encouraging as fundamental to the functioning of our society. So with that, I will submit the case to you all and ask you to vacate this conviction. It's not right and it should not stand.
Thank you. Mr. Schroeder, Mr. Whelan, thank you for your arguments. This matter stands submitted. We are adjourned until 1:30.